The Antidote welcomes Jamie Rowe of Calamity Kills to the show. Jamie, it's a real pleasure to have you here.
Glad to be here, Dave. Appreciate you taking the time to reach out to me and let me be on part of your show. It's awesome.
I should probably mention that I start each interview by asking an artist about their music roots. But now, if I did that with you, we'd be here all night.
That's a lot of truth to that. I can give you a bullet point list of people who made me want to play music. Kiss, Van Halen, Cheap Trick, Stryper, and even glam rock like Poison and Warrant. You know, so and here I am today making, you know, kind of semi-metalcore influenced hard rock. So how that came out, all that, I don't know. But Kiss made me interested in music because, you know, I was a teenager in the 80s and, preteen in the 70s. And I got the Kiss bug like everybody else around that time. They were my, you know, Superman, Spider-Man that happened to play music. But Cheap Trick, I heard one of their songs at an arcade, somebody playing on a jukebox. They made me love music. Like Kiss got me interested. Cheap Trick made me love music. And Van Halen, my mom was a part of the Columbia House Records and Tapes Club where they had that selection of the month. And she ordered a Kenny Rogers album and got the number wrong. And he sent Van Halen 2. And we kept it. So that was a major happy accident. But those are my roots.
So you got to tell me, is that what your life is all about, making music?
No, it's really not, man. It's a major part of it, and it's something I can't shut off. I've always got a song in my head. My wife always tells me, she goes, "You're clicking your teeth," because like I'm hearing like a drum idea or something, and I constantly do that. But you know, if 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I would have said, "Yeah, music's absolutely my life," and now I realize, man, that's minimizing the importance of that. Let's put it this way. If I stopped making music, my life would not get worse, but I might be creatively frustrated because I got, like I said, I've got a song in my head, but man, my life is family. My life is God. My life is, you know, just my friends and our home in Columbia, Tennessee, man, that this is life. Adding music is icing on the cake.
Well, tell you what, how about we chat about Guardian for a minute?
Okay.
Because that's where I first heard your vocals back in the early 90s.
Yeah.
When you joined that band, did you think it was going to last forever?
No. You know what? It's fun. That's a great way to put it. No, rationally, no, I knew it would not last forever. But when it came to an end, it sent me for a loop because I joined Guardian when I was 20 years old. And we basically, you know, I'm not going to say there was never a point where we disbanded, but we stopped being active around 99. So for 9 years of my life, where most people, you know, in their 20s are going to school and starting their lives and everything like that, I was in this rock band. And at 29 years old, you know, I didn't know what to do with myself, man. It was a hard time, but I really mourned the loss of Guardian. And, you know, it was great. It was a wonderful experience in my life. And like I said, I'm talking to you because of Guardian. And I talk to people every day to this, you know, in 2025, I will talk to somebody today due to Guardian. It was a major part of my life, and it seems to be a major part of other people's life. And if you don't know who Guardian is, we were a Christian hard rock band based out of Los Angeles. We came out of the glam, you know, LA Sunset Strip scene, always allowed ourselves to be influenced by musical trends and things we were liking. So our records were all over the place. I think we were pretty good at everything we did. I really do.
Well, I do know that Miracle Mile was Guardian's most popular album.
Absolutely.
But I got to say, for me, it was Bottle Rocket that really grabbed me.
Really?
Now, did you find that listeners tended to gravitate more to one album over another?
Oh, yeah. There's definitely a camp. I mean, clearly Miracle Mile was our quote-unquote hit record. But it's cool for people like you, like that Bottle Rocket connected with. There is a tribe. And it's funny, it's never like Fire and Love was the Guardian record that got me, or it's never Buzz was the record that got me. It's either always Miracle Mile or Bottle Rocket. But that's really cool because we were really in a weird transition because we had been labeled kind of, you know, a hair band, and that was really uncool to be at that time. You know, but at the same time, I kind of emerged more of a songwriter, and I was actually, you know, contributing, you know, the actual music, you know, a lot of stuff, and not just the vocal melodies and spotting in lyrics, but like a song like Salvation and Revelation and things like that. I wrote those in like one day, you know what I mean? And that was coming, you know, there was just me listening, you know, to stuff I was listening to and thinking, you know, and being inspired by the bands at the times, which is like Smashing Pumpkins.
Sure.
even Third Eye Blind, you know, people you wouldn't necessarily equate with Guardian, but that was rocking my world. But that's really cool that you say that, because like songs like What Does It Take from the Bottle Rocket record, even Blue Light Special and Are We Feeling Comfortable Yet, to me, I wrote the music on those things. And to this day, I think you can hear the connection between that and Calamity Kills.
Well, you know, it's sort of funny because I'm trying to cover decades in just minutes here. But now, post-Guardian, you were into some solo stuff like your This Is Home album, but it was country. Country.
No. It was country influenced rock. You know, but hey, we can talk about this because that's cool. Because like I said, we've always, from Guardian, just how I'm wired, I've never been the guy, like, I'm a music fan. I'm not a genre fan. Like, I love music, and I went through a period. Well, let me back up a little bit. I met my wife in 2015 and we married in 2016, and her brother is a really well-known country music writer. He's like 13 or something number one hits and stuff, even, you know, like from everybody from Diamond Rio to Luke Combs to all these people. So I was exposed to like modern country, what they call bro country derogatorily. And it connected with me because it reminded me of the songwriting of the 80s. I said, it's basically Warrant with an accent. And, you know, like I said, from my nostalgic side, that really appealed to me. So there was a time there, I got to be honest, man, probably from 2015 to maybe 2019-ish, early 2020, my go-to music was country. And it's funny because it's not now. You know, it's like I can listen to a few songs and stuff like that, but I listen to way more hard rock and even like 70s, like almost yacht rock sometimes. So I'm all over the place. But I made a country-influenced rock record, and I really loved it. And, of course, it came out right when the pandemic hit, and nobody heard it, you know, but I still love it.
So it wasn't really your alter ego. It's just part of who you were.
Absolutely. It's a great historical document of that time in my life. I'm actually sitting right now as I'm talking to you, sitting in the kitchen where I wrote most of the record. And if you ever see the This Is Home music video, this is the table, you know, we're sitting in here. I'm right here. That's just a reflection of my life, man. And what was cool was, and I may want to get into this later, but I'll say this, you know, I was always involved in quote unquote Christian music. I always wanted to share my faith through music. And around 2000, I was turned on to this book by this author named Bob Briner called Roaring Lambs. And it really made an impact on me that the best way to express my faith is to not pigeonhole it and put it in a box that only certain people hear it. Not play for people who only agree with me. To go out there and be salt and light. Think of those analogies and stuff like that. You know, salt, it doesn't stop the spoilage of meat. It's a preservative, but it slows it down. It adds flavor. And just like anything, if you put too much salt on things, it ruins everything. And sometimes I think that's what I was doing with my Christian music, so to speak. Just putting too much salt on there, you know what I mean? And not being, you know, relatable and not communicating. You know, I don't have to tell somebody, you know, you need Jesus. They know what they need. But if I can write a song that connects with them and it makes them ask questions and they seek, you know, beyond that, that's awesome. That rocks my world.
I totally understand what you're saying.
No, let me back up. It's like, I just saw somebody had sent the year-end like Christian music charts, and it was all these, you know, bands, stuff, all these songs. I've not heard any of them. It's because if I don't go in that neighborhood to seek it out, it doesn't fall on my radar. You know what I mean? So it's just funny that we have this great hope in Christ and we keep it to ourselves.
Yes, too often.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we've really have spoken enough about the past. What I do want to hear about is what inspired you to start up the Calamity Kills project.
Okay, well, here's what's funny is, you know, This Is Home record, which was a country rock influenced record. In 2020, when that went around, I started writing songs again. I constantly write songs. I constantly have a song in my head. And I started writing and like, not like, hey, I'm going to sit down and write rock songs. Rock songs just started coming out of me again. And it's like, I went back and listened to stuff and it was almost like it was fresh and new to me again. So I'd written this song called Sinner's Welcome, which to me was, in my mind, was kind of like an Alice in Chains influence, kind of Rob Zombie type song. And I kind of wrote it you know, to let to people know it's not an evangelical song. It's more autobiographical about me, because it's like, you know, it says, I'm the chief of sinner. I'm a hell of a time. The walking, talking reason to leave 99. A lot of times in my life, that's been me. And I wrote that music and originally went and recorded it as the next Jamie Rowe record. And I was going to do a Kickstarter. And midway through recording the track, I talked to Jamie Perrineau, my producer, who has now become my equal partner in Calamity Kills. I said, dude, this doesn't feel like solo artist music. This feels like a band. And I decided at that point to do kind of like what Trent Reznor does, you know, have a band identity, you know, even though it's your solo project.
Sure.
But make it a band identity. And then I had this brilliant idea, I thought at the time, to get guys in the band that were masked, you know, who you never knew who they were. And I realized now and stuff like that, how many people don't want to wear a mask. And everybody knows what I look like anyway, so I can't get away with it. So there's always Google. So now it's just, it's forming into a band. Jamie Perrineau, midway through making the record, we just decided, let's let this be a 50-50 thing between us. And I, you know, I wrote all the first record. And since then, songs we've recorded, he and I have co-written. And we had some great people like Greg Upchurch from Three Doors Down plays drums on the record. Ray Luzier from Korn, who's become a really good friend. Mm. He plays drums on the record. My buddy Ace from LA Guns. So I seasoned with people. And I got Tony from Guardian to play on the record. But man, it was truly organic. I had no agenda. I didn't say, I'm going to write this kind of song. I'm not going to write these kind of messages. I'm just going to write what comes out. And the Calamity Kills record is exactly that.
So you pulled in all these guests just because you're lazy?
No, to be fair, between myself and Jamie Perrineau, we could make a record by ourselves and stuff like that. Well, there's enough musically diverse talent between us. Now, instrumentally, it's predominantly on Perrineau's side. But just to have like Ray's texture, like how he plays and how he approaches songs. And what's cool about Ray is a lot of people come in and, you know, when they play on a track, they come out and they make their charts and everything. And they treat it like a studio session. Ray listens to the song, doesn't make a chart, and says, I want to feel this like I'm part of the band. And I'm sitting there thinking, Ray Luzier is in one of the biggest hard rock metal bands in the world. And he cares about my little 3-chord songs that I write. So I wouldn't say it's laziness. I'd say it's opportunity, man. It was like, we get some great friends to come in here and make what we have even a little bit better.
Now, you've already spoken about Sinner's Welcome. So let's head back to that.
Uh-huh.
That could be considered a provocative song because you write, I was thirsty, you gave me drink, paid no mind to what haters think, smack-talking church folk causing a stink, losing their minds because you chose me. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that some churches aren't welcoming, so how do you get a church to change?
I think, man, I'm not here to change churches. I'm here to change people. When the people change and become more Christ-like, more grace-focused, more compassionate, it's like I always say, dude, you know, I encounter a lot of people that don't think like me. And how I look at them, I don't use my faith as a weapon to judge them. I don't use it as a faith to tear them down. I look at them and think, I've never met a person who wasn't made in the image of God. And so I think when that mentality would become like the norm, I think it'd be radically transformative in churches and everything. But, you know, that's that song, Trash-Talking Church Folk, Trash-Talking Church Folk. Originally that line said, church folk acting like their shit don't stink. And I realized, and I said that, I said anything, okay, that I can say the same thing without having to say that. But that's really how I felt. And so if there's this, you know, this pious vibe sometimes, and it just, you know, it breaks my heart to know that there are people who want Christ in their life, want God in their life, and they just don't have an environment to find worshipers that's not going to just beat them down. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
And that's where my heart is and stuff like, and you know, I just like, I want to make music, be creative. I have a faith. I fully believe my faith has evolved so much over the last 20, 30 years. But at the end of the day, I'm one of those guys that my phrase is, I believe all that Jesus stuff. I really do. And I think that whenever I pass, I'm going to stand before Christ, man. And that's how I approach life, musically and everything.
I do want to say that I really love Calamity Kills, how the debut turned out.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like you had a pretty firm idea of what you wanted when you started it up.
Absolutely. And that's what I said with the record, and that's why I love working with Jamie Perrineau so much. It sounds like what I heard in my head. And that's pretty crazy. For instance, the Bottle Rocket record, the song Harder Than It Seems. I wrote the music and melody of that song. And that did not turn out anything like I was hearing in my head. And I was really disappointed because I still love the song, but I didn't like that version of it. And with the Kills record, everything sounded like, hey, man, this is what I want to sound like. It actually delivered.
Mm-hmm.
As an artist, that's pretty thrilling. And if I were to make the record by myself, it wouldn't have happened because I don't have the ability to translate what I hear in my head half the time.
Well, you know, some of the songs on Calamity Kills, you point fingers, like on the song Hellfire Honey.
Yeah, I point them at myself as well. Yeah. Well, no, Hellfire Honey. Well, here's a nice story. I work for a company called True Tone. It's been my job since 2012. I'm the multimedia director there, and we make guitar power supplies for pedal boards, and we used to make pedals. And when I say everybody uses our stuff, I mean everybody. U2, Korn, you name it, they use our stuff. So I'm in this musical environment all the time. And through that, my multimedia gig, we were doing video podcasting and things, and I realized halfway, like, man, my stuff doesn't look as good as other people's stuff. And so to make a long story short, I learned the art of like color grading and things. And I realized, oh, that also plays into photography. So wow. I got a Sony camera and I really, really got the photography bug basically from 2020 to like 2022. And I got to the point where I was shooting, you know, other bands. I was shooting artists for True Tone, and the local modeling scene here in Nashville reached out to me and I started shooting models. You know, everything from, you know, just, you know, senior photo types things to boudoir shots. And I remember doing this, what they called a model shootout. And some of these girls had OnlyFans accounts. That's where, you know, people basically make, you know, homemade porn and sell it online. And some of these girls, they would tell me how many Christian/married men were their subscribers and some of their best customers. And I thought of it with Hellfire Honey, I thought the church mindset is, you know, you look at the OnlyFans girls, you look at those girls like, oh, you're the problem. You're doing this. And nobody calls to task the people who are paying the money for them to do it.
Exactly.
And in this case, these people were telling me it was the Christian guys. And dude, I think I saw a statistic, and I'm probably wrong on this. You have to Google it. But I think they said 95% of Christian men admit to pornography use.
Oh, boy.
95%. And so, like I said, when I say I point the finger, I do point the finger, but I'm always aware that that finger points right back at me as well. I'm part of the problem just like everybody else. You know, I have my good days and bad days. But the thing is, I'm aware and I want to do better, you know. But Hellfire Honey was basically a song, like I said, listen to the chorus, you know, Hellfire Honey bound and down. You know, that's the finger point. But the verse is about, you know, Ronnie's got a credit card for living a lie. Another sugar daddy preaching with a plank in his eye. The devil smiles and says, come and see all that Ronnie hides in his history. How many people listening to your show right now I just described? And nobody's talking about it.
Right. And so we should.
We really should. We just did. Dave, you and I just talked about this. We just approached it. And did it hurt? Not one bit, man. You know? So...
Okay, changing things up a little bit here. You recorded a really sweet love song, The Chemistry of Meant to Be.
Yeah.
The cool September when we first met, a supernatural moment, one we would never forget. Barely said a word before we kissed. There was something about you I couldn't resist. So I'm thinking that you're telling me you're a softie.
No, I'm telling you an actual experience that happened, and that's between me and my wife who I'm married to right now. That's literally what happened.
Now you got to tell me, how did she react to the song?
Oh, she loved it. I write her songs all the time, and it makes her feel wonderful. I just write what comes out, and she loves it when what I write comes out is a reflection of her and our relationship. Most people would say this about their spouses, but when I say this, I feel a little bit, she's the best person I know. And so to be able to celebrate her in a song like that, I think is amazing. And it was our first charting Billboard song. I couldn't believe it. You know, it actually went to radio and actually did really well. And, you know, it's just basically it's a love song, but it's a soft hand, you know, covered in an iron fist, you know. But
you know what that song also tells me is that you're a smart guy because you know how crummy it is to sleep in the garage.
Oh, of course. No, the couch would be bad enough. You know what I mean? So the garage. No, but I wrote, you know, a lot of the This Is Home record for Amber as well. So Like I said, I write what I know, but I'm glad you brought that song up because I really love that song. And to be fair, when we were looking for the singles, there's a song on a Kills record called Dark Secrets that I still think is probably the best song on a record, just it's from my great. Opinion. But as you know, with radio, we hadn't established ourselves really as a band. And when you come with a mid-tempo that's almost kind of balladish, you know, slow, it's usually kind of frowned upon. So we went with something a little more up-tempo first, and I thought it would do okay. I didn't know it would do as well as it did.
Something interesting about the debut is that it has so many styles. Mm-hmm. You've got pop, hard rock, metal, mm-hmm. even a bit of electronic.
Yeah.
But the surprising song is Amen.
Oh, man. I had to put that on there, that record. That to me, I view that as a prayer, like a closing prayer. What's originally, it was cool, is it was originally just the first verse and the chorus, and that was it. And when we went to track it, I played it for Perino, and he's like, dude, you need to extend that. That needs to be a complete song. So I added another verse, and I love it because, like I said, the record, you know, is energetic. It's hard rock. It's up. And then there's this ending sense of peace. And I love that. And it's a, like I said, I flex my gratitude muscle a lot. And that's something I have to confess, I haven't done a lot in my life. And over the last like 5 to 6, 7, 8 years, I feel like I don't throw around these terms. I feel like God really started showing me things I need to be grateful for. And I express that gratitude, not just to God, but to people around me and everything. And that song to me is just a, you know, like, I'm thankful for these days. It's a prayer, man.
It does sum up who you really are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Dang, Dave, you was very observant. Like, you're tuned into this. I do quite a few interviews, and I like it when people, quote unquote, get me. You know what I mean? So, because I'm admittedly, dude, I'm a strange bird, man. I really am.
Before we even started this interview, there was something I was really curious about. You've been involved in music forever, mm-hmm. but have you ever reached a point where you said, you know what? Enough is enough. I don't want to create.
Mm-hmm. You know what happened? We made a Guardian record in 2012, 2013 called Almost Home. And it was like a final thing. And just trying to get everybody involved to make that record was like pulling teeth. Like people's schedules were way off. And to be honest, it was not fun to make that record. And if Jamie Perino hadn't been brought into the mix, that record would not have been finished. Just trying to get everybody has these great, let's make this record, get excited about it. But then you realize you got to put the time into it. And people's lives in the band are so different. It was really difficult. After that record was out and ran its cycle, I completely decided that's it for me. My life is great without music, and I'm done with this. Now, during this time, as I said, I always write songs. So I ended up with write songs, mostly for Amber, just for things that I thought was cool, thinking no one was ever going to hear these things. And then in 2018, a friend of mine here in Nashville named Rob Harris, who's a singer-songwriter, he's just a really great guy who's like a Nashville working musician. He plays the airport. He had a writer's night at the Bluebird Cafe, and he called me and said, hey, I know you've always wanted to play the Bluebird. Would you like to be a part of my round? And so I went there, and I said yes, because obviously, you know, if you know anything about songwriting, playing the Bluebird Cafe is like, you know, playing Madison Square Garden for a rock band. It's just a big deal. Mm-hmm. And I went there. It was a writer's round. There's four writers, and we used to play like 5 songs. Like, we do a song, next person does a song, goes in a circle. It's really cool. And I decided to play the songs that I had written for Amber and just for myself here and not do Guardian music or things that people know from my past. And people loved the songs. Even the staff at the Bluebird, who hear everybody, you know, 7 days a week, really were complimentary to me, and it was encouraging. And I told my wife on the way home, I said, you know what? I should do a Kickstarter and see if people really want to hear these songs. I said, and if it doesn't go, I'm off the hook. Mm-hmm. And to be fair, I put that thing up in the back of my mind. I said, I'm going to put this thing up here so I can hurry up and fail so I can get on with my life. And the record got funded in 11 days.
How perfect.
And so that's what brought me back. You know what I mean? So, but there was a time from 2016 to 2018, those 2 year period. And for the first time in my life, since I was like 16 years old, mm-hmm. I did not view myself as a musician. I viewed myself as a former musician who had a great ride, and now it's time to move on. And then A friend of mine wrote a song called You Can't Quit Jesus. Like, you always come back to Jesus. And at the same time, I think it's the same with music. If you're a creative type, you can't quit it. It's, you know, it can frustrate you, but you're going to come back to it.
Well, that debut album, Calamity Kills, came out in 2023.
Mm-hmm.
But you haven't been sitting around because you have a new single out, Starry Yes. Skies 988.
Yes.
Along with Aaron Gillespie.
Yeah, that was a treat. You know, it's funny, I'd written that song in last February, and it was in Suicide Prevention Awareness, and I'd written that song and kind of backburnered it, and we were, you know, doing other stuff for Kills and working on the current singles and current record. And around July, I said, you know what? Suicide Prevention Month is coming up in September. I'd really like to track this song and release it, you know, at the start of September to coincide with that and create awareness. And so we did, and Jamie came in with me, and he retooled the lyric with me and just made it better. You know, I tend to write very basic lyrics a lot of times, and Jamie's more poetic and stuff. So he infused that into the mix. And, you know, just basically just, you know, letting people know that, you know, it's like, look, I've been there. I know what it's like to think like, you know, there's no hope. I just need to give up. And unfortunately for me, usually 8 hours of sleep corrects those feelings. And for some people, it does not. You know what I mean? That's, mm-hmm. It's a very real problem. And I know Aaron, it's funny, Aaron, Ray Luzier was supposed to play drums on it, but he had an issue with like leaving for Korn tour and couldn't. And I was thinking, well, who could we get to play drums on this? It's not like the Nashville session guy that's just going to give us like the sterile thing. And I said, you know what? I think Aaron Gillespie lives in Spring Hill, which is the city next to mine. Let me reach out. I'd met Aaron. I didn't know him, but I'd met him a few times and he knew who Guardian was. And so I literally sent him an Instagram message, said, hey, I've got this song. It's about suicide awareness. And said, would you be interested in playing drums on it? And he's like, yeah, man, I'm in. So He came in for that. And I really started thinking, I told Perrin, I said, you know, Aaron's a great vocalist too. I said, I wonder if he could feature on this and sing on the chorus. And once again, I thought he's not going to do it, or he's not going to want to do it. He doesn't want to slum Under Oath with Calamity Kills. You know what I mean? But he did. You know, he came in and he killed it. And it just, in the awareness because of his affiliation with Under Oath, really helped that song get in the hands of people who I don't have access to. And a lot of hurting kids. And, you know, when I say kids, like I said, that audience skews younger than like a Guardian audience. And so a lot of those kids were hurting and everything. And that song connected with it. I can't believe the amount of saves we got on that on Spotify alone. I think it was like 60,000 spins, which is huge for us because as an independent artist, the first week. And it was just insanely good to see that song with that kind of message connect.
I'm interested in hearing how you would sum up Calamity Kills. Like, what do you want to achieve through the music?
Okay. I would sum up Calamity Kills and goals and everything. To me, I just want to be authentic. And here's what's funny. When I say that, I'm not going to lie to you and be one of those guys like, you know, it's all about the art. I want to make a hit record. I want to make a song that is authentic, meaningful, and it's popular. I mean, that's like, nobody steps up to the plate at a ball game to hit a single. They're going for a home run every time. So I still want to do that. You know what I mean? I have no qualms about that. But the biggest thing I want to do is to never to write or record or anything for somebody else. I want to do it. It needs to be authentic and straight. And like, this is what we want to do. And I want to make it the best I can. You know, I'm a sponge of influences. You know, I hear elements of artists that I love and think I would love to have a part of that in my music and whatnot, but it would be great. And to be fair, the odds are against me in this, you know, because I'm, you know, it's funny. I looked at our Spotify audience the other day and I was shocked. I kind of assumed like the early adopters were obviously Guardian fans, but our main demographic by a long shot is 25 to 34 year old males. And those people weren't even listening to music when Guardian was going. So this is a new audience. You know, I'm 54 years old. I can't believe I got to reinvent myself because a lot of people, especially on the internet and stuff, you know, when I came out with Kills and it sounded a little more modern and current than what they were used to, it's like, you get those people, I call them the internet chads, the comment chads. They're all like, you know, okay, this is, okay, your Calamity Kills thing is cool, but this is you. And will show me something, a picture or video from 20, 30 years ago. I was like, no, it's not me. That was me. And I'm very happy for it. But this is me and where I'm at now. And if I ever have to go back to making music to like fit into a box of either, you know, a genre, a faith, a style, or anything. I'd rather not make music anymore. I'll just write songs for myself again.
Well, man, I appreciate you saying that because that's what I agree with.
Mm-hmm.
Well, listen, Jamie, I got to thank you for coming to The Antidote for this talk about Calamity Kills.
Yeah, man, it's been great. Been absolutely wonderful.